From WHQR Public Media in Wilmington, North Carolina, this is Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. Michael Isikoff is the chief investigative correspondent at Yahoo News. He's also the host of a six-part podcast, Conspiracy Land, that explores how a fictional theory grew up around the 2016 murder of Seth Rich, a 27-year-old employee of the Democratic National Committee. Michael Isikoff has also written three New York Times best-selling books, Uncovering Clinton, A Reporter's Story, and Hubris, the inside story of spin, scandal, and the selling of the Iraq War. His most recent book, out in 2018 and co-written with David Korn, is called Russian Roulette, the inside story of Putin's war on America and the election of Donald Trump. Today, we'll hear about his investigations into the Seth Rich conspiracy theory and his work on the Russian election meddling case that led him to conclude Donald Trump aided and abetted Moscow's attack on American democracy. And we'll find out how the intelligence community, long regarded for its apolitical operations, has of late been feared by both Republican and Democratic interests for covert partisanship. We'll also explore the panoply of so-called news sources available and how news consumers can do a better job vetting those sources. Michael Isikoff joins us from NPR in Washington, D.C. Michael Isikoff, welcome to Coastline.
Great to be with you, Rachel.
Great to have you here. And a reminder for our listeners, today's conversation is pre-recorded. Michael, when I read the title of your book, Russian Roulette, the inside story of Putin's war on America and the election of Donald Trump, I thought some people could hear this as a Trump-bashing book written by and for the left. It sounds like collusion is your thesis, in a sense.
I think the book is a bit more nuanced than that. What we tried to do, what David Korn and I tried to do in the book, was to lay out in as comprehensive fashion how it is that Russia came to do what it did during the 2016 election, the many efforts it made to cultivate people associated with the Trump's campaign, Trump's long association, interest in doing business in Russia, and his strange fascination with Vladimir Putin. But if you read closely, we don't endorse any particular collusion theory. In fact, we dissect the most common one in the book, the Steele dossier, quite methodically. And
yes,
a lot of people on the right have used material from the book to raise questions about some of the left's allegations about Trump and Russia. But overall, I think it's fair to say that it is a damning portrait of both what the Russians did and Trump's acceptance of it, without taking it to the level of alleging, because we don't, a well-developed conspiracy between the Trump campaign and Moscow.
So how then do you define Moscow's attack on American democracy? What does that mean in practical terms? What did they do?
Well, in practical terms, it was you know, every bit as sweeping as Robert Mueller has said in his report. It involved the hacking of American political institutions, primarily the Clinton campaign and the Democratic National Committee, the weaponizing of that information by laundering it to WikiLeaks, and the many efforts it made to cultivate relations with people in the Trump campaign. Now, look, hacking of American political parties was not new in 2016. The Chinese did it in 2008 to both the Obama and the McCain campaigns. It was considered a big deal when they did, by the way. But the Russians did take things to the next level. What the Chinese did in 2008 was standard political espionage. It was it got itself into the computers of both campaigns to develop information and intelligence about who the campaign advisors were, what their attitudes were, particularly towards U.S.-China relations. It's the kind of thing that intelligence agencies do. They want information about who are going to be the next leaders. But the Russians weaponized this information. They used it for political effect. They took that information, got it to WikiLeaks in order to start that drip, drip, drip of leaks that were damaging to the Clinton campaign. And on top of that, I should have mentioned, because it was a major component in the Russian attack, the whole social media offensive. The Internet Research Agency, which was this troll farm in St. Petersburg, created all these fake Twitter accounts, fake Facebook accounts, in which they introduced political messaging, most of it unfavorable to Hillary Clinton and favorable to Trump, to the Trump campaign, disguising themselves as American citizens, as American political organizations, when in fact they were simply Russian trolls working in thousands of miles away in St. Petersburg, Russia.
Right. And I'm going to ask you specifically about some of those efforts. But first of all, you make this assertion at the end of the book. You say whether or not the investigations would ever turn up hard evidence of direct collusion, Trump's actions had provided Putin cover, which you conclude means he aided and abetted Moscow's attack on American democracy. This was written before the Mueller report became public.
Indeed.
Would that report have changed anything about how you drew your conclusions or the way you wrote this book?
Actually, the report confirms almost everything that is in our book. It obviously had new information relating to Trump's attempts to obstruct justice, to obstruct the Mueller investigation and get rid of Mueller, although some of that was known. The degrees to which Trump went were new in the Mueller report. But as far as the core conduct that was being investigated in the first place, no. I think we got it right. I think Mueller confirms most of it. And the aiding and abetting is a reasonable conclusion to draw from the fact that Trump and his campaign refused to accept the findings of the U.S. intelligence community relating to Russia's role in hacking the DNC and getting those emails, those damaging emails to WikiLeaks. Russia, if you're listening, I hope you can find the thousands of missing emails of Hillary Clinton. It was an open invitation by Trump to Russian hackers to help his campaign by locating the deleted emails of Hillary Clinton. His willingness to accept what the Russians were doing did give the Russians cover and, effectively aided and abetted what was a criminal attack on American democracy.
Now, help us understand, Michael Isikoff, why the Russians had such an interest in doing this. When Hillary Clinton served as Secretary of State in the Obama administration, part of her initial agenda was to deliver a reset for the Russian-American relationship. And according to your book, it started out promising enough. There was even a meeting when Russian President Vladimir Putin invited her to a tiger preservation conference and suggested that her husband, Bill Clinton, go with him to tag polar bears. And suddenly things went south. What happened?
Well, what happened was the Russian people grew disenchanted with Vladimir Putin, especially when he announced in 2011 that he was going to return again to the presidency. If you remember, there was Putin had been president of Russia from 2000 to 2008. He steps down and becomes prime minister, which is an inferior position in the Russian system, and Medvedev becomes president. Medvedev was younger. He was more polished. Didn't seem as threatening. Obama thought he could forge a relationship with him, although there were warnings from the very beginning that Putin was still pulling the strings behind the scenes. And then when Putin decides he wants to come back As president, there's an uprising, popular discontent, demonstrations in the streets of Moscow. There are new elections that were filled with all sorts of allegations of fraud. And Hillary Clinton, as Secretary of State, did what American secretaries of state do when there's fraudulent elections by autocrats abroad, which is to speak up for American values and criticize those fraudulent elections. That's what Hillary Clinton did. Vladimir Putin took it personally. He developed a grudge against Hillary Clinton. And that, combined with his more assertive foreign policy — assertive is a very kind way of describing what he did in Ukraine. He invaded the country. He seized the Crimea. It's part of Ukrainian sovereign territory that led to sanctions by the Obama administration and the European Union. Putin was becoming more adversarial to the United States, and he was using the many levers of that he had at his disposal, including the social media offensive and hacking. These are things the Russians are very good at, and Putin used it to destabilize and attack our election.
You're listening to Coastline. We're talking with Michael Isikoff, chief investigative correspondent for Yahoo News and author of Russian Roulette, the inside story of Putin's war on America and the election of Donald Trump. When we come back from this break, we'll find out more about one of the more controversial figures in the Russia probe, Christopher Steele. You're listening to a pre-recorded conversation. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn for Coastline. You're listening to Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn. Today, Michael Isikoff, author of Russian Roulette, the inside story of Putin's war on America and the election of Donald Trump, and chief investigative correspondent at Yahoo News, is with us today. He recently hosted a six-part podcast called Conspiracy Land about the conspiracy theory that grew up around the 2016 murder of Seth Rich in Washington, D.C., which we'll get to in a few minutes. Today's conversation is pre-recorded. But first, Christopher Steele, Michael Isikoff, is one of the most controversial figures in the Russia probe. He created this dossier that intelligence officials still haven't been able to corroborate.
Well, we are we believe we're going to get more information about that very soon, hopefully in the next few weeks, when the Justice Department Inspector General completes his investigation into the use of the Steele dossier in a foreign intelligence surveillance warrant against a member of the Trump campaign, Carter Page. This has been a long drama that begins during 2016, when Christopher Steele, a former British spy in Russia, is hired by an opposition research firm, Fusion GPS, that was working for the Clinton campaign. And Christopher Steele produces these series of memos that make, quite striking allegations about Trump's relationships in Russia. There's the notorious P-tape, the idea that he had been compromised by the Russian FSB, which supposedly videotaped him consorting with prostitutes in his hotel room. I should quickly add that no corroboration of that has ever developed, and makes a series of other allegations about essentially a conspiracy between the Trump campaign and Russia. I met with Christopher Steele. I write about this in the book during the campaign.
How did you get access to Christopher Steele?
Well, he came to Washington, D.C. in September of 2016 and met with a number of journalists. This was arranged by the head of Fusion GPS because they were trying to get the story of Trump and Russia out there. And I should point out that there had been legitimate reasons to be quite concerned about what the Russians were up to. At this point, we knew about the hacking. At this point, we knew that the hacked emails from the DNC had been provided to WikiLeaks. We knew U.S. intelligence agencies strongly suspected the Russians were behind this. We knew about Paul Manafort's role and his work prior work on the payroll of the pro-Russian political party.
But for some reason, that whole notion that the depth and the breadth of the Russian interference in the campaign and in what happened before the 2016 election, the news media wasn't really grasping the implications of that hacking.
Right. Some of us were. I mean, I was among a handful of reporters that were paying a lot of attention to this and doing a lot of reporting on it. But you're right. It hadn't, totally broken through, in part, by the way, because the Obama White House was slow to respond. And this is another matter we deal with in the book, which is that there were people inside the White House, the Obama White House National Security Council, who knew what the Russians were up to, knew, by the way, that they had also, and I didn't mention this earlier, were probing the state election systems,
right,
and voter registration databases. They were quite alarmed by this and believed that the U.S. government had to strike back in real time. That was the only thing that was going to get Putin's attention and get him to stop. And Obama didn't want to go there. He was very reluctant to publicizing this and making a big deal about it. He did a private warning to Putin that a lot of people believed, wasn't going to have much impact.
Didn't really have any teeth, it sounded like.
Yes, and the common assumption was, look, Hillary Clinton's going to win the election anyway. There's no way Donald Trump's going to prevail, and so let's just kick this can down the road. Let the new Clinton team deal with it when she takes office.
And that was the public approach. But then there was also an offer from Jay Johnson. Talks about reaching out to local governments, state governments, to assist with election security. And what kind of reception did that get?
Well, not very well, particularly in red states. The then Secretary of State of Georgia, Brian Kemp, who's now the governor, very conservative Republican, saw this as some attempt by the Obama White House to federalize elections and resisted. I should point out that Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader then as now, was also not eager to endorse what the Obama White House wanted to do on this. He saw this as a way that the Obama White House was trying to help the Clinton campaign. So as a result, the Obama administration was effectively paralyzed. It didn't have to be, but Obama didn't want to risk a political blow-up over the Russia issue on the eve of the election. Far better for him to let who we assumed would be President Hillary Clinton deal with the problem when she took office.
As we look down the barrel of another election and more warnings of Russian interference in American election systems, and we know now that all 50 states were essentially hacked by the Russians, why?
Penetrated in 50 states. Yes.
Penetrated.
Russians certainly tried, yes.
So So given that understanding now, why was this viewed by people like Mitch McConnell at the time? And you reported on a whole meeting that Obama held where leaders of the House and the Senate were invited, no aides were allowed, and this idea of helping states secure their elections was essentially rejected by the Republican side. Why was this viewed in such a partisan way when you're talking about intelligence that had come from agencies that up to now had not been viewed as having a partisan agenda?
Because the Clinton campaign was trying to call attention to the Russian interference, and Trump was publicly disputing it. Remember, you know, how do we know it's the Russians? It could have been some 300-pound guy sitting in his living room, right, watching TV. And given that there was a political debate about what was happening, McConnell and some of these other Republicans on the state level saw any endorsement on their part of the fact that there was a Russian attack on our election was going to help the Clinton campaign and hurt the Trump campaign. And, you know, obviously it was an election season and everybody was thinking in completely partisan terms rather than necessarily what was best for the country.
And it's strange because even earlier in the book, you talk about the first discoveries of the hacking of the DNC. And you also talk about the fact that in the public, the idea of Hillary Clinton's private server and her use of that got conflated with the hacking of the DNC and then the Clinton campaign. But even the Clinton campaign back then was fearful of the intelligence agencies moving. They feared some sort of partisan agenda.
Well, they feared the FBI because Hillary Clinton was under investigation by the FBI over her private email server. And, you know, this was a serious threat to the Clinton campaign, more so than people realized at the time, because the Clinton campaign did a very good job of minimizing what the FBI was up to. And even when the New York Times first reported in the summer of 2015 that there had been a criminal referral to the Justice Department over that email server, the Clinton campaign, you know, pushed back ferociously and suggested the New York Times had gotten it wrong when in fact they had gotten it exactly right. It took a long time for it to penetrate that one of the two presidential candidates was under FBI investigation. Now, what we subsequently learned is that, in fact, no sooner did the Clinton FBI investigation end that the FBI was beginning a new counterintelligence investigation of the Trump campaign, and that was completely unknown to the electorate when it went to the polls in November 2016.
And the Clinton campaign complained vociferously about the
yes.
treatment of their case versus, you know, in hindsight, how the FBI treated its investigation into the Trump campaign. And you explain why. You
yeah.
talk about
yeah.
how the Hillary Clinton private email server case, that probe had become public because the inspectors general of the intelligence community and the State Department had each made referrals to the Justice Department about Hillary Clinton's
exactly.
handling of classified information, and that had been reported to Congress. But why was the Trump campaign probe different?
Well, because it was a counterintelligence investigation, which by definition is classified. You can't conduct a counterintelligence investigation if the targets know that you're doing it, right? You tip off the Russian targets. You tip off anybody in the Trump orbit who might have been assisting the Russians. That's what the FBI suspected, in part based on the allegations in the Steele dossier. And so there was no way that the FBI could go public with what was a highly sensitive, classified investigation.
Near the end of your book, you get into the hundreds of ads that Russian operatives bought on Facebook, Instagram, outfits like South United. And this is This is a Facebook group set up by the Russians with a Confederate flag that says heritage, not hate. The South will rise again. Something like that is very hard, I think, for a lot of people to hear as another prong of Russian election meddling. Can you just talk about the Internet Research Agency and some of their strategies and how that affected the election?
You know, the remarkable thing about the Internet Research Agency, and we deal with this in the book, is that it was not new in 2016. A couple years earlier, in 2014, as we discuss in the book, the U.S. government had a source inside the Kremlin that was warning about what the Russians were planning in the social media space, about both its hacking operations and its social media, the social media component, that the Russians were very intent on trying to destabilize Western democracies, not just the United States at that point, it began elsewhere, and doing so by pushing disinformation out there, pushing false accounts. What happened in Ukraine was in many ways a trial run in which the Russians were, you know, polluting the international political dialogue with blatantly false accounts through the Internet Research Agency. And, you know, the really striking thing is that this got reported originally in the Russian press. There is an independent Russian press, and we talk about a whistleblower who went to a Russian reporter and began to lay out what the Internet Research Agency was doing and the deceptive ways it was manipulating social media. The Russians, independent Russian press picked it up. Then the New York Times Sunday Magazine did a remarkable story in 2015 about how these Russian trolls were creating fake news accounts about chemical leaks in Louisiana, a small parish in Louisiana that freaked out officials in that parish. This was all, so a lot was known about what the Russians were doing in the social media space, and yet for some reason it fell between the cracks of U.S. law enforcement and intelligence agencies. Nobody was really focused on it. Nobody saw it as the domestic threat that it really was.
Do you think people see it now? And I'm not talking about people at the highest levels of the intelligence community, but members of the American public. Do you think people are starting to see it?
Well, there's certainly been a lot more attention as a result of all the investigations into what the Russians did. But do people accept it? Look, you know, the real threat here is that our media has become so polarized that we're all in our own silos. We just read the news that conforms to our prejudices. And, you know, whether you get it, you know, it's reflected in the Twitter account you follow, the Facebook news feeds that you pre-select for yourself, you know, which cable news shows you watch. And so, you know, given how stratified the media has become, this social media threat, this manipulation of news, this disinformation that we saw in the 2016 campaign is so much easier today and so much easier to pull off. And it's not just the Russians. You know, we're starting to see it from other foreign actors, the Iranians, the North Koreans, the Chinese, and we can also expect it from domestic actors as well.
And Michael Isikoff, you have spoken with NPR's Morning Edition host Steve Inskeep about your podcast, Conspiracy Land, which just takes apart one of those conspiracies, one of those false narratives. And what's new about this idea of the murder of Seth Rich, and you'll explain to us what the major conspiracy around, the theory around that is, but it was new. You uncovered the fact that Russian intelligence planted that conspiracy theory, that essentially Hillary Clinton had Seth Rich murdered. Can you just tell us briefly who Seth Rich was and why this became part of the campaign?
Sure. And I should point out, this was a whole other component of the Russian meddling during the 2016 campaign that was almost completely below radar. Seth Rich was a 27-year-old who was working for the Democratic National Committee on voter protection programs for the election. One night, on after a night drinking at his favorite bar in July, to his neighborhood group house, talking to his girlfriend on the phone, and he gets assaulted, shot, and killed. Now, the police quickly concluded this was a botched street robbery. There had been a rash of street robberies in his neighborhood, about 30 blocks north of the Capitol, by the way. In the weeks before his death, 7 in the 6 weeks prior to Seth Rich's shooting. And so, it had all the earmarks of a botched street robbery. It is true that his wallet and other personal effects weren't taken, but what appeared to be the case, we do know that Seth Rich resisted when these assailants accosted him. He had bruises on his face, bruises on his knuckles, and so in their panic, they shot him and fled. That, at least, is what the police quickly concluded. But within 3 days of his death, when nobody was really paying much attention to this outside of the neighborhood where he lived in Washington and on some of the local Washington TV newscasts, report is circulated by the Russian intelligence agency, SVR. It's their version of the CIA, that alleged that Seth Rich was on his way to talk to the FBI when he was murdered, gunned down by assassins working for Hillary Clinton. This, began to migrate and get traction on alt-right websites. It played into one of the far right's favorite memes, that there's some sort of Clinton body count of people who go missing or get murdered if they're if they might say something critical about the Clintons. And it eventually found its way all the way to Fox News, where it was being trumpeted by Sean Hannity.
You're listening to Coastline. We've got Chief Investigative Correspondent at Yahoo News and creator of the podcast Conspiracy Land, Michael Isikoff, with us today. When we come back from this short break, more on how conspiracy theories flourish and how news consumers might do a better job of vetting their sources. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline. You're listening to Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. Michael Isikoff is the author of 3 New York Times best-selling books. His most recent, co-written with David Korn, is called Russian Roulette, The Inside Story of Putin's War on America and the Election of Donald Trump. He is chief investigative correspondent at Yahoo News, and he also hosted the 6-part podcast series Conspiracy Land about the murder of DNC employee Seth Rich in Washington, D.C. in the summer of 2016. Rich's death turned into a long-running and still alive, apparently, conspiracy theory that Conspiracy Land systematically unpacks and debunks. Michael Isikoff joins us today, courtesy of NPR in Washington, D.C. Today's conversation is pre-recorded. And so, Michael Isikoff, just before we went to break, you were explaining that this report about Seth Rich ultimately leaking information about the Clinton campaign really got traction thanks to Russian Russian intelligence created this story, and then alt-right news sources, information sources, started to really spread this conspiracy theory around.
And those Russian trolls that we were talking about were heavily involved in promoting this conspiracy theory. There was one of those troll accounts, fake accounts on Twitter, was called 10_GOP. It masqueraded as being the Twitter handle of the Tennessee Republican Party. In fact, it was, you know, a troll in St. Petersburg, and it was continually tweeting and retweeting about Seth Rich. And then, people in the United States would see these and then retweet. It was a way that this, you know, totally bogus message about this young man who was murdered in Washington was being amplified and spread on social media. I should point out two quick things. One is that there's absolutely no evidence that Seth Rich was in any way in providing material to WikiLeaks, or that he was murdered by anybody associated with the Clinton campaign. That was just, you know, utterly nonsense and not a shred of evidence to back it up. But why did it get traction? Because it was very convenient for both the Russians, who knew what they had done. Russian intelligence knew that they had hacked the DNC and provided the DNC emails to WikiLeaks. It was very convenient for the supporters of Donald Trump, because it was a way of deflecting from the investigation, the Mueller investigation into Trump's Russian ties. And so it was a form of collusion of sorts, not to elect Donald Trump, but to protect Donald Trump and deflect from the real investigations into what actually happened during 2016. And just one final point, as much as we and others have debunked this conspiracy theory, it still has traction. Just this week, Rudy Giuliani, President Trump's lawyer in the Russia probe, retweets a tweet from one of these characters who we deal with in conspiracy land, Matt Couch, somebody who's really out there on the far right fringe and has made all sorts of horrible allegations about the Trump about the Seth Rich family covering up details of Seth Rich's death. His brother was supposedly complicit, according to Matt Couch. Again, not a shred of evidence to back it up. And Rudy Giuliani retweets a tweet by Matt Couch about Seth Rich's death, suggesting that there are unanswered questions that need to be resolved.
So you have many examples here of Republican players, right-leaning folks, promulgating these conspiracy theories. Is there evidence that the left does the same thing when it suits their partisan interests?
Oh, look, sure. I mean, conspiracy theories are not unique to the far right. They're as prevalent on the far left as you can get.
Give us an example of one.
Well, look, I mean, 9/11 truthers who believe that the World Trade Centers was a controlled inside explosion. We weren't attacked by Al-Qaeda. It was the Bush administration that was doing it to find an excuse to invade Iraq. I mean, that's one that was, you know, traction on the far left. Over the years, there have been many, and, you know, certainly the very idea that, the original conspiracy theory in modern American political culture was the Kennedy assassination, and the idea that this was done by the CIA or the FBI was something that had enormous traction on the left. So conspiracy theories are a part of our political culture, but the point we make in conspiracy land is that there's something new that has happened here, and that is with the onset of social media, with the stratification of the media in writ large, it is these sorts of far out ideas get far more traction than they ever got before, because you speak to an audience uncontradicted and uninterested in real facts, but just interested in hearing conspiracy theories that conform to their political prejudices. And so, we are in a golden age of conspiracy theories right now. That's one reason we wanted to do this this podcast, Conspiracy Land.
So does this mean that the idea of gatekeepers of any kind are gone, and now it's up to information consumers to start becoming more discerning, raise their level of discernment to the level of the panoply of sources that are out there? I mean, how do you start asking people or causing them to be interested in being more discerning about what they consume?
You know, it is, I think this is a really serious long-term threat to our democracy, disinformation, propaganda, and its proliferation on social media. Because you're right, the democratization of the media from 30, 40 years ago, when we had three television networks that dominated the news space, and a handful of major newspapers. Today, there's news for everybody can get the news they want, not the news they need. And this is a serious issue that has to be addressed. Certainly, we all have to be more discerning, learning more media education, how to recognize fake news from real news, what are trusted news sources, what are not, and the role of NPR and other mainstream news organizations. It looms larger than ever, that we all have to do a better job of educating the public about what's real and what's fake.
And what are some ways, are there some simple takeaways that somebody listening to this might be able to carry with them and think, okay, the next time I'm on social media, checking social media, I might ask this question about something I'm looking at?
Yeah. I mean, look, the most important thing is don't just go to the news sites that give you what you want to hear. Do some independent fact checking on your own. We all have access to Google. We can all tap into real news sources as opposed to fake news sources. Look, it's a problem. It's a problem that certainly has been exacerbated by this president, who has labeled, anything he doesn't like as fake news. When you get that kind of and calling the press the enemy of the people, I mean, that is strident, really creepy language that echoes, phrases from the 1930s and the rise of communism and fascism in Europe. We cannot succumb to that kind of thinking and that kind of talk about the people who are legitimately trying to bring you real facts and real news.
But I guess the question for the public is, who are those people, and how do we know when they're trying to bring us legitimate facts and legitimate news? There's an example in Conspiracy Land. There was a phone call with a widely respected journalist, Seymour Hersh, that was recorded. And it contains some misinformation? It was rumor that he later denied.
I have to say that was one of the more awkward for me and disappointing when I had to call Seymour Hersh, because he's a true journalist hero. I mean, he's ferocious investigator who's broken major stories for decades.
Remind us about some of his
My Lai massacre in Vietnam, to Abu Ghraib prison in Iraq, to CIA spying during the the 1970s. These were major stories that Seymour Hersh broke, and he was really a hero to, and is a hero to people like me, who grew up wanting to be investigative reporters like Seymour Hersh. And yet, you know, he succumbed to these Seth Rich conspiracy theories. He indulged them in a secretly recorded phone call with a guy by the name of Ed Batowski, who didn't tell Hersh that he was recording him. And Hersh shot off his mouth and said, and gave credence to the Seth Rich conspiracy theories when he really didn't have any information to back it up. And as he has pointed out to me and others, he never wrote about it. And so, you know, if he really believed something was true, he would write about it. He didn't write about Seth Rich, but he did shoot his mouth off in this secretly recorded phone call, which you can listen to on Conspiracy Land. It created a lot of mischief and was used by Butowski and others to propagate this completely bogus conspiracy theory.
And there's this moment in Conspiracy Land when you're challenging a young woman who has published, she has released the recording of this
yes.
Seymour Hersh phone call that contains not, I don't want to call them facts, but, you know, things that Seymour Hersh
right.
later denies.
Wild allegations. This right. is a woman named Cassandra Fairbanks, and she acknowledges to me that she has no idea whether what Seymour Hersh was saying in this secretly recorded phone call was actually true. But it doesn't matter because people would be interested in hearing it. And, you know, when I said, well, you know, most people think responsible journalists have a responsibility to verify whether something is true before they put it out there. And
you're
says,
really naive,
well,
Michael Isikoff.
You're naive, Michael Isikoff. You don't understand how the internet works.
Right.
And that's a pretty chilling comment.
And perhaps one of the more accurate things that she's done by pointing that
yes.
out. I mean,
yes.
what you're talking about, this debate that you were pointing out basic journalistic principles. It's a reporter's job to verify facts before the reporter publishes those
right.
facts. She was saying this is a different landscape.
Right, and that's exactly the problem that we've been talking about here. It's a different landscape in which you can put anything out there on the internet, and you can, foreign governments can, terrorist groups can, criminal organizations can, anybody can put stuff out there masquerading where it's coming from and influence public opinion. And that's why it's such a dangerous development for our democracy.
And part of the reason I asked you in the beginning of our conversation, Michael Isikoff, about the title of your book, Russian Roulette, The Inside Story of Putin's War on America and the Election of Donald Trump, is because of the politicization, I can't say that word right now, of the news media, and the fact that your co-author, David Korn, writes for Mother Jones. We're going to have listeners here who will just dismiss you guys out of hand. You contribute to MSNBC that some here in North Carolina would describe as the left's answer to Fox News. How do we get past this?
Yeah. Well, look, I've got a long history in this business of being an equal opportunity abuser.
And you are in the book, I should note. You don't pull any
yes.
punches on the Obama White House.
We do not pull any punches. We are quite critical about the way the Obama White House handled this.
Would you say that the Obama White House blew it? When it came to handling the Russian matter,
I think some people in the Obama White House have said they blew it. I mean, we do have this scene where some of the people who I talked about earlier, the National Security Council, were pushing this very aggressive response to Putin, and they get told by then National Security Advisor Susan Rice to stand down. The president doesn't want them pushing this stuff, and you know that's something that doesn't hold up very well when you see the full full extent of what the Russians were up to. We don't cover up for Hillary Clinton either. We point out that many of those emails that were released were quite damning to her, and raised questions about the Clinton Foundation. We talk about the $500,000 that Bill Clinton accepted for a speech in Moscow while his wife was Secretary of State. The kind of conflict of interest questions that anybody would raise. So I think the book speaks for itself. It doesn't, as I said before, take a quite critical stance, examination of the Steele dossier. So I don't think we have anything to apologize for in how we put the book together.
And that's this edition of Coastline. Michael Isikoff, thank you so much for being with us today.
Anytime, Rachel.
The book, Russian Roulette, The Inside Story of Putin's War on America and the Election of Donald Trump. The podcast is Conspiracy Land. Coastline's producer is Caitlin Freund. Technical director is Ken Campbell. Production manager, Caitlin Hanrahan. Rachel Keith is news producer. Coastline is a production of WHQR Public Media. If you missed part of this episode, look for it at WHQR.org. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline.